Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest will be Lierre Keith. She is the author of a new book called The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability. And I'll tell you more about Lierre in just a bit when she comes on. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the news. Talk to you about Thanksgiving, which was just awesome, and of course share my weekly recipe with you. So I was not with all of you last Thursday as we all celebrated Thanksgiving, but I did my annual Thanksgiving feast for the less fortunate on Tuesday in Rufus King Park. And once again, it was just an amazing coming together of hundreds of people working towards creating a Thanksgiving traditional feast of home-cooked food for hundreds of people that waited online for hours in the park to get a really wonderful hot meal. And also they get some coats and they get a mobile food pantry, so they went home with groceries. And every year we do this, and it's just a phenomenal undertaking. How many people come through my home, and I'm always just blown away by the amount of goodwill and love and energy that people bring into my home. I finish the event and I'm always thinking that the people that work together to create the event, I think we're more nourished even than the people that actually took the food in the park. It's really nourishing. We all need avenues to give back, and very often it's hard to find those correct avenues, and this is just easy for everyone. I make it easy. They just sign up and they show up, and it brings together such a diverse group. We have young people making Thanksgiving cards and old people just chopping at the table and all colors of people, and it's just an amazing event. It's probably the most diverse location on Long Island during the holidays. It's just really beautiful. So I will be doing it again for Christmas. We will be cooking on the 17th and 18th and serving on the 19th. So look at my emails, and there's a doodle document on my email blog that you can sign up and participate in the Christmas one. I really wish Christmas and Thanksgiving were a little bit more spaced apart, so they wouldn't be right on top of each other. But nevertheless, they are what they are, and we will be coming together as a community once again to create a Christmas event for those less fortunate. So we'll also be collecting coats for that. We also collect secondhand jewelry. If you have jewelry in your jewelry box that you do not wear, polish it up and put it in a gift bag or a box and bring it to the IE Green Homestead, and we will share that with people online as well, so that they have really nice appropriate gifts for their teenage girls or guys. So please sign up for that, and I hope to see many of you for the Christmas event. Yesterday there was a great rally and public hearing in New York City to divest from fossil fuels. Right now, the New York City Pension Fund, which is, you know, the fund that all of the New York City union workers participate in, they fund a lot of fossil fuels, fuel companies and tar sand projects, et cetera. And so there's a big push to try to get them to divest. 350.org started this movement years ago, really, first going towards colleges to get their large endowments to divest from fossil fuels, and it has been spreading around the country. The city of Seattle, I know, has divested, and I believe a few other cities, and we'd like New York to follow suit and to divest from fossil fuels. So, if you see a petition come your way, please sign your name to it, and anything you can do to write to your schools where you have graduated from and ask them to divest their endowments from fossil fuels, all of it would be really a good and positive movement. There is a charity event coming up called Nothing Wasted, and this is going to be out on Long Island at the Millville Marriott. And it will be an evening of beer and food aimed at combating food waste. And food waste, as you know, has been an issue that I've talked about a lot. It's, you know, 40% of the food grown worldwide is wasted. You know, in different countries, it's wasted for different reasons. In our country, it's wasted because people buy too much and throw it out and don't eat what they buy. But in other countries, it's more of a distribution problem. But either way, we all need to address food waste, and I'm sure that will come up later in my conversation with Lierre as well. But this should be a good fundraiser and raise awareness about food waste as well. Also, on November 30th, there's a Food is Medicine Summit at Hunter College. That's actually today, later today, all day long. And it's about food as medicine. And we all know that the power of food and that what we eat affects our health. And this event should be really great. So if you can make it down there, you should check that out. Also, later on this afternoon, there's an event called The Art of Resistance, honoring New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. And that's going to be at Studio 54 Art Space out on Long Island in Massapequa. And all of these events you'll find on my website. December 15th, NOFA New York is having an online auction. It's called Buy It Local, and there's a holiday gift auction. And you can look at the different items that they're offering. You can buy them as gifts for people. NOFA New York is actually having their winter conference on January 19th to the 21st. I'm really excited to be doing a cooking demo there. And the winter conference is a wonderful opportunity for farmers and producers and food activists and food lovers to come together in a safe space at the Saratoga Hilton in Saratoga Springs and participate in workshops and talks and screenings and have fun together, dancing. And there's going to be all kinds of events going on there. So it's a three-day event from January 19th to the 21st. And if you can make it to that, you should definitely come. There's also the annual Brooklyn's annual Laka Festival, December 18th. And that takes place at the Brooklyn Museum. And it's a wonderful event that's put on every year. And it supports the work of the Sylvia Center, which is a nonprofit organization that is dedicated to addressing food-related diseases and food insecurity. They have a farm called Catskey Farm, upstate New York, and it's a wonderful event, so it should be a lot of fun. So if you can come to that, please do. You can check out a lot of these events, or all of them, on my website at iegreen.com. Okay, the Friday before Thanksgiving, I'm sure you all heard about the leak in South Dakota from the Keystone Pipeline. Of course, you know, there was all this talk about the pipeline leaking, and of course those in charge were telling us how safe it was and how it wouldn't leak, and here it is. Already, 210,000 gallons of oil has leaked in South Dakota. It was a few years ago when I actually rallied down in Washington, D.C. in front of the White House and got myself arrested in protesting the Keystone Pipeline. And unfortunately, it moved ahead, and it has just been approved again, another pathway through Nebraska. Anyway, it's just bad news. So anything you can do to reduce your own fossil fuel use, but also to stand up against these pipelines, we really all need to come together around this, because it's just devastating to the environment. It's really bad. So before I invite Lierre Keith on, I want to share with you my weekly recipe. And this week, I actually hosted a dinner at my house with my synagogue. It's a progressive dinner, and people, you know, it's a kind of like a potluck, and then we all go back to the synagogue for desserts. But the dinner, because they know that I'm a chef, they give me all the people with the different food allergies. So I had people here that couldn't eat fish, couldn't eat meat, couldn't eat dairy, couldn't eat gluten. It was just amazing. So I made a vegan moussaka with potatoes, portobello mushrooms, and chickpeas. Now, I've shared this recipe before, but I actually used tempeh in it. But I also had someone that couldn't eat soy at my table. So this dish really, really was allergy-free, unless, of course, if someone was avoiding nightshade vegetables, they'd be up the creek with this recipe, since it does have potatoes and eggplant in it. But it was a big hit, and so I want to share that with you. So instead of, I've done this recipe before. Instead of tempeh, I used chickpeas for some of the protein replacement. So I started with eggplant and potatoes. I had two large eggplants that I didn't peel. I just cut them lengthwise into slices that were about half an inch thick. And I used four potatoes that I sliced into thin rounds, a half a cup of olive oil, and kosher salt. And first what I did was just cut up the eggplants and the potatoes, put them on large cookie sheets with parchment paper, brushed both sides with some olive oil, put a little bit of kosher salt on them, and baked them in the oven until they were soft. And I baked them at a high degree, like 450 or 475 degrees in the oven, just for about 20 minutes until they were soft. And to keep them from burning, I actually laid another piece of parchment paper on top so that they would just steam inside the parchment paper. And when they're soft, you can remove those from the oven. Then for the filling, which was mushrooms and chickpeas, I started with 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 1 medium yellow onion, 4 cloves of garlic, 1 can of organic chickpeas, 2 portobello mushrooms finely chopped, 2 assorted peppers also chopped, 2 teaspoons of dried oregano, 1/4 teaspoon of allspice, actually, I'm sorry, 3/4 teaspoon of allspice, 1/4 teaspoon of ground cloves, 3/4 teaspoon of cinnamon, 1/2 teaspoon of sea salt, plus some to taste, freshly ground pepper, 1 can of fire-roasted tomatoes, 8 sun-dried tomatoes that I pureed, 1 tablespoon of tomato paste, and 1 bay leaf. And for the filling, I heated the olive oil in a large skillet. I added the onions and cooked those until they were lightly browned. Then I added the peppers and the garlic, continued cooking for about 3 more minutes. Then I added the mushrooms and the spices, cooked that down for a bit. Then I added the chickpeas, the fire-roasted tomatoes, the salt, and cooked that down. And then lastly, I added the tomato paste, the sun-dried tomatoes. And I mixed all that up, brought it to a low simmer, covered it, and let that cook down for about 15 minutes, stirring occasionally. Then for the cashew sauce, which is a replacement for a bechamel sauce, I used 2 cups of cashews that I soaked for 2 hours in water, mixed it with 2 cups of water, 1/2 teaspoon sea salt, 1/2 teaspoon ground nutmeg, and 1 1/2 tablespoons of nutritional yeast. And that you just, you know, process on a high speed of a Vitamix or a food processor until it's really, really fine and smooth. And that's the bechamel sauce. And then the topping, I used some breadcrumbs. Since this was gluten-free, I used gluten-free breadcrumbs with a little salt, 1/2 teaspoon of ground minced garlic, olive oil, and 2 tablespoons chopped parsley. And so I just toasted the breadcrumbs with the garlic and the salt in a frying pan with a little bit of olive oil and added the parsley, and that was the topping. And then to assemble it, I first layered the eggplant down onto a baking sheet. I'm sorry, into like a lasagna pan. Laid the eggplants down, then, and I, of course, greased the lasagna pan first. Laid the eggplant down, then I put some of the filling in there, half of the mushroom and chickpea filling. Then I laid down a layer of the potatoes. Then I added more of the chickpea filling. Then I topped it with some more of the eggplants and potatoes. Then poured the cashew cream on top of all of it, and then sprinkled the breadcrumbs on top of that. And I baked it in a 350-degree oven for about 30 minutes covered. Then I removed the cover and cooked it for about another 15 minutes, allowing the cashew sauce to get a little golden brown on the edges. And then I garnished it with fresh parsley, and that was it. It was really super easy, super delicious, and I recommend making it. And the thing that's so nice about this dish is it can be made ahead of time. You can make all of it ahead of time and just pour the bechamel sauce or the cashew sauce on right before baking it. And or you can bake the whole thing and freeze it and just pull it out of the freezer and put it into the oven. But sometimes you really want a recipe that you can prepare ahead of time so you can have all your time with your guests. And this is one of those recipes. So as always, if you do make the recipe, please let me know how you like it. I love hearing from all of you. And you can write to me at bhavani@ieatgreen.com. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Liare Keith. She is a writer, a small farmer, and a radical feminist activist. She's the author of 6 books, including The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability, which has been called the most important ecological book of this generation. She also co-authored with Derek Jensen and Eric McBay The Deep Green Resistance, Strategy to Save the Planet. She's also been arrested 6 times. Ooh, you got me beat. And you can read more about her. Her website is www.liarekeith.com. Liare, are you with me?
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Sure. So your book is amazing, and it's really interesting because, you know, reading your history, I understand that you were a vegan for 20 years and then found yourself in ill health and realized that the vegan diet was not right for you. But you actually go further saying that the vegan diet's really not right for anyone. So can you share with us some of your research? Tell us a little bit about your history, why you might have become vegan to start with, and then what you realized was unhealthy about the vegan diet.
Well, I became a vegan when I was 16 years old, which is pretty typical. And I became a vegan the way that most of us do, which is we are convinced by somebody else in our lives to do it. So we meet somebody else who is, you know, a vegetarian or a vegan, and it seems to make sense. And at age 16, I certainly didn't have any counter information about why this might not actually be true. But I will say that, everything that I was told about factory farming is certainly true. And I think no matter what you decide to eat in your life, that, you know, we all should be opposed to those kinds of practices, which are simply cruel and wasteful. And, you know, there's no reason not to oppose factory farming. It's just wrong. But, you know, at age 16, I really didn't know anything. And, I looked at the pictures and I heard the information, and I was horrified by it. So it seemed like the obvious thing to do. And that is, you know, you're sort of handed this complete picture that if you simply refrain from animal products, you can save the planet and save animals and save humans. There'll be more food to go around and save your health. And so it seemed very complete. So I did it. And I was, you know, I just took it up and was convinced and tried to convince others and lived a very ideological life for 20 years, even as my health was failing. It's a very hard thing to come out of when you're in it. The thing about being a vegan is that it really becomes your identity. You know, it becomes who you are. It's not just who you eat. You know, so you know when you do bump up against problems, either factual problems, informational problems that challenge your ideology, or when your health starts to fail, it's really hard to take a look at it because it feels like, you know, your sense of self is being threatened. So it was not an easy process to come out of it. You also will lose friends, and that's something that a lot of people deal with when they stop being vegan. It has cult-like elements, and I don't think there's any point in making that pretty. It can be a very hard thing to leave. My health failed pretty catastrophically. I have permanent damage from that diet, and some of it I have recovered from eating a more appropriate human diet. But it was a long journey. So I ended up writing a book about it because I got just bored having the same conversation with people over and over because it's a lot of information. You know, it was 20 years. I still was someone who was very engaged with environmental issues, and I wanted to understand how the planet got into such bad shape, and I kept hitting this wall where I realized agriculture was the problem, and I couldn't accept that as a vegan. So it was a real that was the angel I wrestled, and I did not end up with a real blessing at the end of it. But you do have to face the truth if you make a claim to be someone whose life is about truth and justice. You do eventually have to face it. So. And I was somebody, and still am somebody, who does want to know. I am not somebody who flinches from hard truths. I really want to know what is the worst thing out there. What is it? What is left to face here? Because I don't think there's any way forward if we don't actually face the facts. So all of that, was why I wrote the book. And I also want the people who care the most about the planet to understand the depth of the problem. And I know in my case, at least, when I became a vegan, It's very easy to stop asking questions. You feel like you've faced the worst of it, and it's factory farming, and that's not actually true. That's just the beginning of what we have to face about what's happening to our planet. So I really want those people who are motivated by compassion and justice and some longing for sustainability to really understand what we've done for the last 10,000 years and a better way forward.
Mm-hmm. Right. So So the vegan diet itself, which for those, I'm sure most people who are listening, know that a vegan diet is, an animal-free, cruelty-free diet. So depending on how strict, some people don't even eat honey because of taking the honey from the bees. Some people take it to their clothing as well, and they don't wear any clothing made from animal products either. But in your actual health, what kind of problems did you incur from the vegan diet? And is there a way to do a vegan diet more healthfully, or is it just the vegan diet by the nature of cutting out animal products? You're keeping yourself away from some of the minerals and vitamins that one would get from animal products.
So 2 years into my vegan life, I ended up with a degenerative disease of the spine. And people's spines are not supposed to fall apart for no reason at age 18. That's what happened to me. So your joints are going to fall apart on that diet. And it's very, very common for people who are long-term vegans. So that's problem number one. I also ended up with...
And is that from lack of calcium? Because,
it's a lack of a number.
I say you get so much calcium from dark green vegetables. So...
It's
what is that
calcium,
from?
It's also a whole bunch of different minerals, especially zinc. Zinc is very important for the health of your joints. The other problem is that the human body actually cannot absorb minerals without the presence of fat. And, when you eat these kinds of high-carb, low-fat diets, you're not getting enough fat for your body to actually get the minerals that you might, even if you are eating a whole bunch of them, you have no way to absorb them. That's just how our digestion works. So that's another problem with that. A third problem is that, we're encouraged to eat these, whole grain, whole bean, whole food diets, and I was very rigorous about that, almost religiously so. But the problem with things like whole grains is that, these are seeds, right? So these are, the babies of the adult plants, and they come equipped so that they will not be eaten. This is the whole future of that species is wrapped up in those seeds, and they are really great chemical warfare agents because that's the only protection they have. They can't run. They can't fight. So how they protect themselves is with chemicals. And seeds all contain these anti-nutrients. They contain different things that will hurt animals that try to eat them. And so one of the ways that seeds do that is they have what are called anti-nutrients that actually act to block the absorption of various substances. So what the seed is saying, what the plant is saying is, well, fine, you can eat me, but you're going to suffer for it later. And, you will not then be healthy enough to reproduce. So this is not a good food source. There are ways to fool seeds into disabling those anti-nutrients and those different chemicals, but it's a long process. And this is why traditionally, you find things like sourdough bread, which takes 3 or 4 days of fermentation. That is to disable the anti-nutrients in wheat. I didn't know that when I was a vegan, and most people don't know it. We've lost those traditional food ways for the most part. So I was eating just straight up, whole wheat, whole brown rice, whole this, whole that, and every time I did, the anti-nutrients in those little substances One of the things they do is they will latch onto the minerals in your digestive tract and just take them right out of your body. So eating all the minerals in the world wasn't going to help because, again, they were inaccessible to me because it was whole grains. So that's the downside of the whole grains, right? It's, you know, we don't even know this. Most of us aren't even aware of it. So that's another problem. And then there's just the general lack of minerals in a vegetarian or a vegan diet. It's, plants just don't have a lot. Meat, of course, has huge amounts. So if you compare, for instance, muscle meat to any plant, you know, you pick any plant you want, the highest nutrient-dense one you can find, the muscle meat will have anywhere from 10 to 100 times more nutrients than the plant. And then if you compare that to organ meat, which, you know, we've lost culturally, we've just, most of us don't eat organ meats anymore. It's just way too ethnic. You know, we don't eat chopped liver. We don't eat the kinds of things that our grandparents would have eaten on farms, you know, in whatever tradition we're from. But that's really the sort of gold standard for humans. And the organ meats will have 10 to 100 times more nutrients, again, than even the muscle meat. And that was something I never ate. You know, I ate the standard American diet for 16 years, and then as a vegan, I certainly wasn't going to touch that stuff. But, you know, around the world, those are the foods that are considered sacred. It's usually the liver, the heart, the brain, and that's the most nutrient-dense food that there is. And it's a lot of minerals. And also things like bone broth or bone marrow. And again, as a vegan or a vegetarian, that's not stuff you're going to touch. And that's traditionally where people have gotten most of their minerals. So all of that together just spelled disaster for my joints. So that's permanent. That's not one of the things that, you know, is going to get better in my case. I also developed really severe blood sugar problems, which is fairly predictable if you're going to eat a, you know, a diet that's essentially sugar three or four times a day. And you can call it, you know, complex carbohydrate if it makes you feel better, but the job of your intestines is to break that down into simpler substances. So it just ends up being a pile of sugar. So I, you know, burned through my insulin receptors at a pretty young age. I very typically for women who eat these kinds of low-fat diets, I stopped menstruating and did some permanent damage as well to my reproductive organs. And I also ended up, some of the stuff that, you know, I got was, you know, a lot nowhere near as severe. So, like, really dry skin, dry hair, all that kind of stuff. And that, you know, was resolved pretty quickly when I started eating animal products. But it's really hard having dry skin for 20 years. I mean, it hurt. It was so bad it would keep me up at night in the winter. And that's right. Not normal, you know. So there was that. And then also there's that sort of constellation of depression, anxiety, that general, you know, mental fog and lassitude, which, you know, I now understand the lack of animal fat as well as the lack of good quality protein will do that to your brain. You know, it's almost impossible to keep a stable mood state. And that's one of the main complaints of people who give up these diets is, you know, the depression and the anxiety were just too much. And I understand now the pathway that leads to that, but at the time I didn't. I had no idea what I was doing. I just knew I felt terrible every single day. And that was one of the things that, you know, very very quickly got better. I mean, within 48 hours of eating a more appropriate diet, it just was, the veil was lifted, and I could see in color again, and life was good. And it had not felt that good for 20 years. So in a nutshell,
wow,
that's
very
pretty
interesting.
Much what I did.
You know, so you hear so many people talk about, you know, the health benefits of a plant-based diet. And they don't even refer to it as vegan as much as plant-based. You know, the more fruits and vegetables you eat, the healthier you're going to be. And they, you know, they promote plant-based diets as a diet to actually heal disease and heal cancer and heart disease and all these other things. Can you talk a little bit about the controversy or the, you know, the juxtaposition of these two different diets?
So this gets very political very quickly. Starting in the late 60s, there was this huge push to try to get people to eat you know, essentially a grain-based diet. And the reason for this is really economic, that you have this sort of takeover of our food stream by corporate America, and they make the most money, essentially, when we eat cheap carbohydrate, because that's the food that's cheapest for them to produce. And then, you know, they can refine it a little bit more, turn it into, you know, cereal and sort of process things. And that's where they make the most profit. So there's this takeover at the USDA, which is the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The USDA is not charged with human health. Okay, that's not anything that's in, you know, their mission statement. Their job is to sell commodity food. Their job is to sell, you know, cheap grain, essentially, and to get us to eat as much of that as possible. So that's, like, one of the main economic reasons that all of this happened. So from that point forward, government policy takes a turn. And instead of promoting the foods that we know are protective of human health and that humans have eaten for thousands of years, you know, there's this switch, and all of a sudden they're telling everybody, oh, you're supposed to eat these, you know, diets that are low in fat and high in carbohydrate. Now, the protective foods did not go down without a fight. You know, they tried to have public hearings about this to put up these new dietary guidelines, and they actually had to extend the hearing by 8 weeks because there were so many doctors who came forward and said, this is a mass experiment on the American public. You can't do this. They lost, and, you know, that was 50 years ago. And we can see the results. We've never had rates of diabetes, cancer, heart disease, obesity like we are seeing now. And this is a direct result of those policies that were put forward. The specific, the hearings were, it was called the McGovern Committee, the McGovern hearings, because George McGovern was the one that was in charge of this. And, you know, it's all public information. Anybody can go and read what happened during those hearings. But that was when this whole thing kicked off. And it was, you know, strictly about money with a little bit of ideology thrown in. The guy that was actually, you know, under McGovern who was in charge of this was a vegetarian, and so he tried very hard to get his ideology written into the national guidelines for diets. But here we are now. You know, it's been 50 years, and we can see the glorious results. People have stopped eating as much fat. But, you know, the amount of fat that's gone down by, you know, like 20% in the American diet, especially animal fats, huge decline, and what has increased, of course, is the carbohydrate intake, and we can see what's happened. The evidence is visible to anybody with eyes. It has made us fat, sick, and stupid, and I don't say those things as insults. I just say them strictly as descriptors. That is what has happened to the American public under this diet, and it's, you know, they've never been able to prove that there was a connection between eating animal products and something like heart disease. You know, it was all just smoke and mirrors, and you know, with all the amount of money that went behind it, they were able to convince us to try this. And some of us did, myself included. You know, I live to tell the tale, but I do have permanent damage from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know in the McGovern hearings, you know, they also, you know, he had recommended back then that people eat less meat, actually. And the meat lobbyists are the ones that made them write, you know, meat with less fat and reduced fat meat, you know. But one of his recommendations is also to cut down on meat intake. So do you think there is that the American diet does eat too much meat, or do you think that there's no amount of meat that's too much?
We have a natural off switch for both protein and fat. So if you just eat until you're full, you will have eaten enough. We don't have an off switch for carbohydrate, for sugar intake, which is why, you know, when you talk to people about what do you binge on, you know, what are the foods, what are the scary foods that you can't stop eating in December, you know, as they are spread across your work surface, it's always potato chips, cookies, cake, it's sugar. You know, like that's where we have no way to know that we've had enough. And these foods can be very addictive. You know, I've seen the brain scans, you know, the MRIs they do on people. And it can be more addictive than cocaine for some people. The pleasure centers light up like nothing else when sugar hits the brain, and we don't have a way to turn away from it unless we have a lot of willpower. So I don't think that it's possible to eat too much. Like when you say to somebody, how many hard-boiled eggs could you eat? They know their limit. Like it might be two, maybe it's four, but at a certain point you're like, no, I just don't want any more. But if you ask the average person how many candy bars, you know, how many cookies, like we all just groan because we know most of us are going to eat the whole bag. You know, there are those lucky people who just don't crave sugar, and more power to them. But for most human beings, no, it's just an addiction. And it's the same with fat. Like if I said how much butter could you eat, or how much olive oil could you eat, how much coconut oil, we all know there's a limit, and maybe it's a tablespoon. Maybe you could eat 2 tablespoons at once, but then you know, like, you're done. You just, and that's the off switch. You know, your brain says, okay, we've had enough for a while. And again, that's not true for any kind of sugary substance. So I don't think it's possible to eat too much because we know what the limit is. Like, we have a biological limit built into our brains. Up until very recently in human history, we never had access to this kind of, you know, sugar, carbohydrate stuff. It just didn't exist in our world. It wasn't until we took over the planet and started doing agriculture and provided ourselves with, you know, a pile of carbohydrate 3 times a day that we ever had access to it. It doesn't really exist in nature. There might have been fruit once a year. You know, there would have been some fruits that, you know, would ripen and, you know, be available in the fall. But you have to remember, too, that the fruit that we all eat at the grocery store is stuff that has been highly domesticated probably for 5 or 6,000 years. And when we domesticate fruit, we do 2 things. We do our best to cut down on the anti-nutrients, which are usually taste very bitter for a reason. They're poisonous, right? We cut down on the bitterness of fruit, and, of course, we breed them to be sweeter and sweeter and sweeter. So when you're eating an apple, it really bears no relation to the wild apples that are still there in the Caucasus Mountains. I mean, they're barely edible. We've added a pile of sugar to those as well, so that we wouldn't really have had access to anything like that before 6,000 or 7,000 years ago.
Really? And what about the quantities of meat? I mean, I get it with the carbohydrates, but, you know, when they show, you know, they used to talk about, you know, half your plate should be the protein and then a quarter be a carbohydrate and a quarter be a plant. And they've kind of switched that around now to say, you know, if you are going to eat meat, meat should be just a quarter of the plate, a smaller piece of meat. What is your idea on that? Do you feel like Americans especially eat too much at one sitting of meat, or do you think the quantities that they ingest is okay?
You know, so part of the, so there's 2 things. One is, you know, again, I don't think it's possible to eat too much meat. I think that is, you know, biologically what we evolved eating, and I think it's the food that we need. It's the nutrient-dense food that our brains require and that our bodies require. The problem is the carbohydrate, and this is not food that we evolved eating, and that's why it wreaks so much havoc across our interior landscapes. You know, the only way that we have to handle, you know, a flood of sugar into the bloodstream is with a release of insulin, and it's a very, very brute instrument, because what happens is, you know, you trigger that insulin surge, and insulin grabs everything out of your bloodstream as fast as it can, because it's a biological emergency. Our brains can only survive in a very narrow range of sugar. If it's too high or too low, you're in trouble. And anyone who's diabetic can tell you that. You can fall into a coma pretty quickly. So insulin is released as an emergency measure. It latches onto everything that it can, trying to get all the sugar as fast as it can, shoves it into your cells, out of your bloodstream to save your brain. But, of course, it's grabbed way too much because it's a blunt instrument. You know, this is not a finely tuned mechanism. So now you don't have enough blood sugar, and this is where the cravings start. And this is where you're on that blood sugar roller coaster. So you start the day eating cereal or toast with skim milk. There's no fat. There's nothing to slow down that sugar. Hits your bloodstream. Insulin is released. And, you know, it grabs everything, gets it out of your bloodstream as fast as it can. And then an hour or two later, you now have the blood sugar crash. So now you're compelled to eat again. And it's not because you have weak willpower. It's because you are indeed in a biological emergency. Your blood sugar is too low. So now you eat again, but what you're going to eat is another high-carb, low-fat snack because that's what you've been told by your government for the last 40 years is the healthy food. So, you know, you're going to eat whatever, a little, you know, a cracker or a whole grain whatever thingy or maybe some nuts if you're lucky. And then the whole thing starts all over again because it's too much carbohydrate. So you've got too much sugar in your blood, insulin is released, now it's too low, you've got to eat again. And that is the roller coaster that most of us in America live on day to day, and that's the problem. So we were never meant to eat that amount of, I mean, the amount of carbohydrate they're expecting us to eat right now ends up being about 200 grams a day, and that ends up being really, you know, over a cup of sugar at, you know, when all that is digested. And there's no possible way we were meant to eat that much sugar, but that's what it breaks down into, you know, when you're in your intestines. So this thing where they've demonized animal products just doesn't make any sense to me from a biological perspective. We have no way to handle that load of sugar without doing tremendous damage to our bodies. Meanwhile, if you eat, you know, fat and protein, you have stable blood sugar all day long. You have all the nutrients you could ever need. And you will have that happy, stable moon state, which will tell you, yes, this is the food you should be eating.
Uh-huh. So do you eat mostly like paleo now? Like,
Yes, I would say I eat a paleo plus a dairy. That's what I eat.
So the whole, in your book, you talk about agriculture as like one of the big problems. Can you talk a little bit to my audience about agriculture and how you see that as, you know, historically as where the problem started?
Sure. So we have very little understanding of what agriculture is. You know, we live in an agricultural society, and it's like air or God or like, you know, things you don't really question. They're just sort of there. But this is a very specific human activity. And in very brute terms, you take a piece of land and you clear every living thing off it. And I mean down to the bacteria at the end of the day. And then you take that land and you plant it just for humans. So it's biotic cleansing. You know, we've all heard of ethnic cleansing. Well, this is biotic cleansing. You know, it's every last form of life is removed from that land in order to do agriculture. And that's kind of a long-winded way of saying mass extinction. Because all those plants and animals, you know, from the magnificent megafauna that we all find so noble, down to the little tiny ones that we can't even see without a microscope, you know, those are all the creatures that make the web of life possible, where they all have something that they are doing to bring resilience to the biotic community. And we're killing all of them when we do agriculture. They have nowhere else to go. We take their home. You know, we either kill them or push them off so that they die, and then there's just nothing but humans on it. And that's what has happened for the last 10,000 years. Agriculture started in 12 or 13 places around the globe, and always in river valleys, and that's for a reason. But the point is, it has now taken over the entire planet. Everything that could have been taken by farmers has been taken. So there's a few spots in the globe that are too hot, too dry, too wet, too whatever, to do agriculture, and those have been more or less left alone, but everything that could have been taken has been taken. So all the forests and the prairies essentially are gone. Most of the wetlands have been drained. In fact, 98% of the world's old-growth forests and 99% of the world's prairies have disappeared, and that's the passive voice. Really, they've been destroyed, and they've been destroyed by farmers to do agriculture. So that's what we've done, and sort of 40% now of the planet's primary production and a full 80% of the indirect production now goes just to humans. So that's what we've done. We've taken over the planet, and we've skinned it alive. You know, by 1950, the world was essentially out of topsoil. This is not a plan with a future, because what we've been eating ever since is fossil fuel. So, yeah, you can blow it through the fossil soil, but, you know, eventually we're going to blow it through the fossil fuel as well. This was a terrible mistake, and Jared Diamond, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, he has an article that's...
Sorry, can you say the name of his book again?
Jared Diamond.
Uh-huh.
He has a book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, and he also has a very famous article that he wrote previous to that book, and it's about how agriculture was the worst mistake that the human race has ever made. And I agree, and that's why, because it's an inherently destructive process. See, up for our first 2.5 million years on this planet, we lived as hunter-gatherers, and we participated in those biotic communities. You know, we took our nourishment from inside them like every other creature, and we lived more or less in harmony. And, you know, you can't make an argument that everything is always perfect that humans do, but more or less, yes, it's a very sustainable way to live. And all of that changed 10,000 years ago when we took up this inherently destructive activity. And it didn't just change our health status. It also changed our social arrangements. It changed human culture very dramatically, because we went from being more or less egalitarian with each other to living in very hierarchical, militaristic, violent societies, because that's what agriculture ultimately demands. It's based on drawdown and overshoot. So because it's an inherently destructive activity, you will eventually use up your soil. You're also destroying, you know, the water table. You're destroying the rivers. You're going to run out of everything eventually. There's a surplus that's created for a little while. So human population expands, you know, really dramatically, you know, in the first few centuries that people do this. And then you're faced with this inevitable crash because you're out of soil and you're out of trees and you're out of water. And so you really, your only option at that point, you know, if you're dependent on, for your basic goods, if you're dependent on getting them from somewhere else, I mean, what that means ultimately is you're going to conquer your neighbors. So that's the pattern that agricultural societies always follow. There's a bloated power center in the middle, and that's surrounded by conquered colonies from which the power center extracts what it wants. So whether you're talking about, you know, ancient Egypt or ancient Rome or ancient China or wherever, it's the same pattern. So you've got this militaristic, hierarchical civilization, and they just conquer the region, and they enslave all the people, and they will blow through that ecosystem as well. And then eventually the whole thing collapses. And there's no civilization that has ever lasted more than 2,000 years. And 2,000 years is essentially as long as you could ever hope for the soil to last. So as long as the soil lasts is as long as the civilization lasts, and that's it. Then it will all collapse. And that's, this civilization will be no different.
You like to think that people are getting smarter. Of course, that's not always the case. But many people realizing that, I mean, you're seeing more and more young farmers, especially, you know, taking up sustainable agriculture, organic agriculture, regenerative permaculture, you know, all these different names for ways of growing vegetables and replenishing the soil at the same time. Do you feel like that's a possibility, or do you think that that's just a fancy name and not really doing anything?
So when I say agriculture, what I mean is, very specifically, annual monocrops. So I'm talking about mostly grain, so wheat and corn, soy, rice, those kinds of things. I think that, you know, when we're talking about things like fruits and vegetables, it's a slightly different category. I would not call that agriculture per se. I would call that horticulture. And so you have horticulture, you have pastoralism, you have hunter-gatherers. Those ways of humans providing food, at least theoretically, can be sustainable because what they are based on is perennial polycultures. And a perennial polyculture is the exact opposite of an annual monoculture. And when we're talking about grain, that's what we're talking about, is an annual monoculture. But anything that's based on perennial plants in place, you at least have a shot at doing that sustainably, because that's really the only way that the soil is rejuvenated. You know, when you talk about things like vegetables, I mean, vegetables really only provide about 4% of our calories. It's a fairly marginal amount, and I don't really care what people do in their backyards to raise vegetables. But most of the ways that people regenerate soil to make vegetables, we're not actually regenerating soil. All we're doing is borrowing from somewhere else. And I came up against this myself as I tried to grow my own food because I realized, well, that's fine. I can go to the dump and I can get the leaves and the grass clippings and all this stuff that people don't want, and I can use that as soil amendments and I can use that to make better soil where I am. But the land where that was taken from is where that stuff should be. So that land is being degraded so that I can have better soil where I am, and all I'm doing is shifting nutrients. I'm not actually building it. The only thing that really builds soil is forests and prairies. So it's leaving the perennials in place. And then the animals, of course, have to be integrated into that. And, you know, you can try to reproduce that on a farm, but there's no way to do that growing annual monocrops. So that's the problem. And that's, again, what I, as I define agriculture, and I think as most people who really, you know, investigate these issues, that's really what agriculture is. Is that the annual monocrops, where the land has to be cleared over and over to plant the annual seeds. So, but, you know, permaculture is, I mean, I've studied permaculture pretty deeply, and at least the original permaculturists were very clear about this, that it really had to be that perennial skeleton was really, you know, the center of, if you were going to try to rejuvenate soil, and that was really the goal, you know, was to build topsoil. It was the first commandment of permaculture, was to build soil. It had to be perennial. So it was either grasses where you were grazing animals, or it was repairing forests or doing things like, you know, forest gardening with, you know, fruit and nut trees and stuff like that. But the perennials is the point, because it's really only the perennials that can do that job. The annuals don't have the root system for it, and they just, it's not their job. Annuals do something else for nature, but they don't build soil.
Uh-huh, right. Right, and you're right that if you're doing it sustainably, you do have to take the compost matter from somewhere else to add to the soil.
So we're just shifting nutrients when we do that, and people need to understand that. Like, it's you're not actually growing the soil in place. You're just bringing it in from somewhere else, and that's it was a real problem for me, just ideologically. You know, as I started to grow my food, I realized, I was like, oh, I'm not actually doing the thing that needs to happen here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just taking it from somewhere else, and that it's kind of a, you know, it's a hard wall to hit.
Right, right. Well, I'm sure in your research and in your changing your diet from a vegan diet to a meat-eating diet that you recognize that the type of meat you want to be eating is not meat that is raised in an industrial agricultural way. You want to talk a little bit about what kind of meat you do choose to eat and you know, and where people can find that and what the differences are between the industrial agricultural model of raising meat versus the meat that you're choosing to eat.
Yeah, that's really key. It's really, really important that people understand this. So, for instance, ruminants, like cows or bison, are designed to eat grass. That is their food. That is what keeps them healthy, and that is what also keeps the world healthy. Grasslands must have ruminants or they die. So, you know, these are all creatures that work together to create a living planet, and you can't remove one and expect the web to hold. And ruminants are a keystone species, which means they're really important to the health of grasslands. And we can talk about why. I mean, there's very specific reasons, there's specific things that ruminants do that nobody else can do. But the take-home point really is that to keep those, to repair the planet, we've got to have the grasslands. And that's the food that, you know, I would really like to direct people toward. So you can find grass-based farmers everywhere now. I mean, it's been a real explosion over the last 10 years in people doing this in an appropriate and in a restorative way. And it really changes the nature of the actual products that you're eating. When cows are in these factory farm situations and they're being fed essentially corn, nothing but corn, it makes them very sick because it's not their natural diet. Corn is much too acid for their stomachs. So they end up with holes in their stomachs. They end up with toxified livers because their blood is poisoned. It's really nasty. I mean, besides the fact that they're suffering, the products that come out of that are really not fit to eat. And the amino acid profile is completely different, so the fats are all wrong, and the proteins are all wrong, both. So you're going to have way too many omega-6s, for instance, and not enough omega-3s, which I know is getting a little technical, but that's actually very key to human health, is right now we have way too many omega-6s in our diet, and that's very specifically because of eating agricultural foods that all seeds have way too many omega-6s, and it's really only appropriately fed animals that are going to give you a good balance of the omega-3s. And there are some Americans that have so few omega-3s in their body that they can't even be measured in a laboratory. Like, there's no omega-3s left. And so omega-6s are responsible for all kinds of inflammatory conditions, and everything from Alzheimer's to diabetes to depression has been linked to elevated levels of omega-6s. So you really want to cut back on those omega-6s as much as possible. And your best source of omega-3s is actually grass-fed beef. It's not even seafood, which I know gets, people take various fish oils and stuff, and that's not a bad thing to do particularly. But if you're eating an appropriate diet from animals fed appropriately, you will have a correct balance of omega-3s to omega-6s. And so that's the way to do it, is really to make sure that the animals are fed appropriately. And most of these farms where you can buy that are, you know, based on grass, where you can buy grass-fed meat and whatnot, they let you come visit. I mean, they encourage people to get involved and to feel a connection to the farm, to the animals, to the land. And you can go with your own eyes and witness. You can see how happy the animals are, and you can see that they're restoring the land. You can see year by year how much more soil there is, and that's really the key thing. Really the only way that we are going to stop global warming is to reverse the damage that we've done by agriculture. Global warming did not start in the year 1800. It accelerated in the year 1800 with the introduction of the internal combustion engine and people being able to suddenly use fossil fuels in ways that they'd never thought of before. Yes, that's a terrible accelerant to the problem. But global warming actually started with the invention of agriculture,
mm-hmm.
because it's the destruction of the soil. And that's literally what agriculture does. It introduces more bacteria into the soil by introducing temporarily more oxygen. I know I'm getting technical here, but the bacteria then just burns through the soil and releases all that carbon, because carbon is what it's made out of. And so by destroying the soil, you release all that carbon. And it's beginning of agriculture is when it starts, especially the beginning of rice agriculture. Rice is particularly bad for this. So if we want to sequester that carbon, the very best thing we can do is just let the grasses come home and let the ruminants come along with them, and they will again sequester that carbon into the soil. Here, I'm going to give you a number, which I think is very helpful, very hopeful. If we were to repair even 75% of the world's trashed-out grasslands, even 75%, not even 100, just 75%, within 15 years, we could sequester all of the carbon that's been released since the beginning of the industrial age. So that would bring carbon down to maybe 335 parts per million, which is well below that 350 red line. And all we have to do is stop destroying. Just put down our weapons and stop the war against the planet. Let the grasses come home. Let the bison, the cows, whoever it is that belongs there, let them come and do their thing. They know how to build soil. It's what they've been doing for millions of years. We don't need any high-tech solutions, no crazy scientists, just cows and grasses. Bison and grasses will get the job done. But you right now can buy this food that is actually doing that repair and that restoration. And the best website that I know to find it is called eatwild.com. And it's just eatwild.com. And it's a woman named Jo Robinson. She's written a number of books about how wonderful grass-based farming is and why it's good for us and why it's good for the planet. But the key point is you can go state by state. You can pick the region where you live, and you can find the farms that are doing this right. And you can go there, and you can buy all kinds of different meat, and you can buy dairy products and eggs, anything you want they've got, and develop a relationship with your local farm, support your local economy. But most important is they're sequestering carbon, and that's really the emergency, you know, that we're at now as a planet.
Wow. Well, Leah, thank you so much. We actually, you know, used up all of our time. I had so many more questions to still ask you. I have had Jo Robinson on my show. Book Eat Wild is really great, as well as the website. So I, you know, agree with you. She's a great resource. But thank you so much for joining me. Your journey's been fascinating. You know, I like to always present to my listeners all the different sides so that people can make their own informed choice. I think we all agree that industrial agriculture is bad for the planet on any scale, and everyone has to find the diet that works for them. But I thank you so much for sharing your journey and joining us.
Well,
so, and everyone out there listening, thank you so much for listening and joining us, and I'll see you all again next Thursday. Have a great rest of the week. Bye for now.